And now, from a novelist who's won all the major sci-fi literature awards going, he's bagged a Nebula, won a Philip K. Dick, and been a victor of a Hugo. Do you see what I did there? William Gibson wants you to spot some pattern recognition in the penultimate offering of his 2003 novel.
Starbucks, she thinks, seated in the one near Blue Ant, beneath exactly the same faux Murano lamps they have in the branch nearest her apartment in New York, is a strange place in which to feel this upset. She and Boone have managed to get here via some highly uncomfortable and basically nonverbal form of decision-making, Case not having wanted to stay at Blue Ant for a second longer than she needed to. And now she's waiting for their order at that same round-topped drink delivery they all have. Case imagines the decor somehow fosters emotional neutrality, a leveling of affect. She can feel the blandness actually start to calm her down. But then he's there, placing their lattes on the table. She glares at him, struck dumb with the irritation she feels.
"You look angry," he says.
"I am. Aside from Dorothea having my old therapist's notes, courtesy of some shady Russian tax lawyer in Cyprus, and her mission statement to make me insane enough to leave the country," her voice sounds surprisingly calm, "aside from that, I'm questioning whether I can work with you."
"I think I can understand that," replies Boone.
"And then you ran and told Hubertus everything without consulting me." He shrugs.
"The night we got back from Tokyo, I thought I'd check up on you. I couldn't sleep. There were men watching the flat in Camden, in a car across the street. That was when I called Big End and told him what was going on, and that I thought these guys were working for Dorothea. He called her, then we had a very early breakfast. Dorothea joined us for coffee."
"And you came to the flat at 1 a.m. to see if I was safe?" she asks, suddenly full of a concern she finds confusing.
"Like I said, I couldn't sleep," he says sheepishly.
She puts her coffee down.
"Thank you." "So," he says, "do you think you can work with me?"
She looks him in the eye. "Only if you keep me in the loop. I have to know what you're actually doing. Can you do that?" He tells her he can, within limits, as he's leaving for Ohio that evening. Sigil Technologies in Columbus, a company specializing in watermarks for all forms of digital media, quite possibly responsible for the watermarks on the footage. "And what do you do when you get there?" she asks. He calls it social engineering, shoulder surfing, something he excels at in the world of geeks. He checks his watch.
"I have to go to Selfridge's. I need a suit, fast."
"I can't imagine you in a suit," she says.
"You don't need to,"
he says, standing, small leather suitcase already in his hand.
"You're unlikely to ever see me in one."
He smiles. "But I'll bet you look good in one," something in her says. It makes her blush. Now it's her turn to stand, feeling incredibly awkward, reaching to shake hands. He squeezes rather than shakes, leaning over to kiss her lightly on the cheek. And then she's watching him go out the door, past a girl with Maharishi parachute pants embroidered with tigers, who, seeing the expression, whatever it is, on Case's face, smiles at her and winks. Climbing the stairs, she reflects on how she feels no interest now in doing the Bond thing. No spit-secured hair waiting to be checked, no talcum doorknobs. Less a matter of faith than a sort of fatalism. Anyone able to get into her therapist's Fifth Avenue office and steal or copy the notes on Case's sessions would be able to get past those locks, she has decided. She powers on the computer, opens Netscape, and goes to her footage forum, carefully watching the keystrokes required to get there. If Dorothea was telling the truth, her burglar had installed software on this machine that records the user's every keystroke, the recorded sequences retrieved elsewhere via some sort of electronic back door. The forum is starting to look unfamiliar after her long absence. She doesn't recognize most of the handles of the posters on the current page. She imagines the recent news special on the footage will have generated a wave of newbies. She sits back and stares at the screen, hands in her lap. The keyboard spooks her now. and she imagined shadowy figures in another room, a sort of Man from U.N.C.L.E. room, staring at a huge screen on which there is nothing but this forum page, waiting for Case to do something. She lets them wait, then closes the browser and powers down. She cables her laptop to her cell phone. If Boone was right when he checked her computer back in Tokyo, this one isn't passing on any keystrokes to the Men from U.N.C.L.E. Although, she thinks, entering Hotmail, what if they came round while she was out and... She can't live that way. Refuses to. 3 emails. The first, a brief hello and take care, is from Boone. Not, she thinks, the most eloquent of correspondents. But she asks herself, what is she expecting? Shakespeare from a layover at LaGuardia? Parkaboy next, telling her Judy Keiko has more or less fallen in love with the poetry Taki has been sending, and that she has been sending him increasingly explicit replies. The third from a friend in New York, telling Case her apartment has been broken into. Nothing taken, just messed up a little. Weird, but nothing to worry about. Case scowls at the screen, feels like hurling something at it. No fair, no fair. She doesn't need this. Case closes her eyes and sees her blue-floored cave, her $1,200-a-month rent-stabilized apartment on 111th Street. And suddenly, she's dead tired, as if Case Pollard's standard time had clicked forward 5 hours. Trembling with it, though at the same time knowing she won't be able to sleep, she shuts down the laptop, disconnects the cell phone. She feels like crying. But she does sleep, and has utterly no memory, subsequently, of any transition to West Broadway, where she stands in the middle of empty, white-coated pavement, a thin inch of fresh snow, in some deep and deeply silent hour of the night. Neither footprints nor tire tracks mar it, and as she turns to look behind, she sees no footprints there either, not even her own. And she wants to call out, but something prevents her, and she struggles to take one step, then another, and then she is running, the unzipped Rixons flapping between her arms like wings. She looks up then, and sees twin towers of light, sharp-edged and tall as heaven. As her head goes back to find their tops, a vertigo seizes her. They narrow up into nothing at all, just a vanishing point, like railway tracks up into the desert of sky. "Ask him," her father says, and she turns to find him, dressed as she's imagined him to have dressed on that morning, his good overcoat open over his business suit, right hand extended, and in it the black cylinder of a Kurta calculator.
"The dead can't help you, and the boy's no good."
"Father!" And managing to speak, she wakes, awash with grief and terror, and some sense of a decision made, though she knows not what, nor yet by whom. The Case knows she is awake, and that she has things to do. She powers up the laptop. 1 email.
"Hello, Case Pollard. How are you? I am fine. I hope you are well. Ngemi."
Her scalp prickles. Ngemi, the black man with the calculators from what seems a lifetime ago. She types her reply, that dreamlike Tokyo feeling washing over her once more. "I would like to speak to your friend with the glasses. I think he can help me with something." An instant reply.
"Hello, Case Pollard. I am going to see him this very morning, train from Waterloo to Bournemouth. My friend there loans me a car to see the man with the glasses. Baranov is his name. Why are you awake?"
The time in the corner of the screen, 4:33. She types her reply. "Why are you awake yourself? Can I come with you? I can't explain, but it's very important." Another almost instant reply.
"I wake early. See you at the station."
The train from Camden High Street reaches Waterloo at 7:15. Ancient escalators carry her to the concourse, beneath a few pigeons and a four-faced Victorian clock, above schedule boards and travelers wheeling ballistic nylon cases toward the Channel trains. She picks up a newspaper and drinks a nasty soft drink and wonders why she bought it.
The tabloid doesn't go down any better, composed in equal measures of shame and rage, as though some inflamed national subtext was being ritually, painfully massaged for whatever temporary and paradoxical relief this might afford. Both go in the bin as Ungemi approaches, large and black, zipped into a tight leather jacket, and carrying a sort of carpet bag and some African-looking hand weave.
"Good morning," he says, looking mildly puzzled. "You wish to visit Baranov?"
"I do," she hears herself say. "May I go with you?"
"It is a peculiar request. He is not a man whose personality can be said to improve. All of his moods are unpleasant. Have you purchased a ticket?"
"Not yet."
"Come with me, then."
"2 hours to Bournemouth, according to Ungemi, though previously, he explains, it had been a quicker journey. The new high-speed trains running now on aging, unreplaced rails." She finds Ungemi a surprisingly comforting presence with his creaking leather and professorial gravitas. He tells her that Baranov has recently lost out on the auction of a rare calculator to a Bond Street dealer. She mulls this over as the train rolls along on the aging rails. She looks out on patchwork fields, sunlight flashing from the occasional puddle. When had she last ridden on a train? Not a subway, but a real train through open country. She can't remember. Instead, she remembers her first view of Ground Zero in late February. The viewing platforms, the unnaturalness of so much sunlight in that place. They had been pulling out a PATH train buried there amidst the rubble. She closes her eyes. In Bournemouth, Ungemi leads her several blocks from the station, through the oddness of an England that is not London, to a quaint little greengrocer's shop. Here he is greeted by an older, earnest-looking man with lighter skin, neat gray hair, and a fine-bladed Ethiopian nose. The greengrocer evidently from his spotless blue apron. The man gives Ungemi a set of car keys and a plastic bag containing plums and 2 ripe bananas. She follows Ungemi along the street to where he stops and unlocks the passenger door of a dark red mirror-world car, a Vauxhall. Ungemi sits behind the wheel for a moment, then inserts the key. Very shortly, they're negotiating complex roundabouts at speeds that have Case closing her eyes. Finally, she opts to keep them shut. When she opens them, she sees rolling green hills, a ruined castle. 20 minutes later, they are in countryside of a vaguely agricultural sort, sheep on a hillside. Soon, they are climbing single-lane gravel around the side of a hill. As they round it, Case sees below them a curiously desolate-looking complex of buildings of various sizes, all of brick, no visible activity. Descending, the Vauxhall's tires crunching gravel, she sees chain link and barbed wire.
"It is a former training facility," Ngemi explains. "MI5 or 6? I think 5. Now they breed and train police dogs here, according to Baranov. A most ill-favored place."
He turns off the gravel onto actual dirt, no more than a rutted path, splashing through brown puddles. She sees small trailers parked between woods and the fenced compound, perhaps 7 of them, as deserted-looking as the brick structures, next to the compound, but clearly not a part of it. "This is where he lives?" asks Case.
"Yes, with gypsy families. These are their caravans. He rents one."
"Have you ever seen them, these gypsies?"
"No," he says, bringing the car to a halt. "Never."
She looks out at a large rectangular sign, peeling plywood up on 2 lengths of galvanized pipe, lettered black on white. "Ministry of Defense. This is a prohibited place within the meaning of the Official Secrets Act. Unauthorized persons entering the area may be arrested and prosecuted." Ungemi gets out stiffly, stretching his long legs, jacket creaking. Case gets out, too. There is a silence here. No birds sing. If there are dogs, shouldn't she be able to hear them? Uncut grass, wild shrubbery with small yellow flowers,
wires strung between tall columns of discolored concrete. It all feels old and somehow dead. They approach what she assumes is the caravan in question. It has a shallow, centrally peaked roof that reminds her of drawings of Noah's Ark and books for children. It doesn't look as though it's been anywhere for a long time, grass grown up around it, hiding any wheels it may still possess. Its windows, she sees, have been sealed over with galvanized sheet metal. Ngemi calls out Baranov's name, though not very loudly. He pauses, advances. The caravan's door, beige and burgundy, doesn't look as though it could ever fully close. Ngemi raps softly.
"Bugger off," says someone from inside.
It is a voice of utmost weariness made peevish with pain. Ngemi says something about calculators, about having a share of money for Baranov. The door flies open, kicked, it seems, without Baranov having to rise from where he must be seated, somewhere within the darkness.
"Who the hell is she?"
"You have met her," Ngemi explains gently, "briefly in Portobello."
"And why would you bring her here?"
Baranov leans forward slightly, so that sunlight glints flatly on his glasses. All the weariness is gone, his voice taut and careful, menacing in its precision.
"I'll let her explain that," Ngemi says, glancing at Case, "after you and I have sorted present business."
He hefts the carpet bag in Baranov's direction, as if indicating the nature of the business.
"Baranov has room for only one visitor at a time," he explains to Case. "Excuse us, please."
He climbs into the caravan, which sways on its springs alarmingly, with a sound like the rattling of empty bottles. Ngemi, hunched almost double beneath the low roof, casts Case an apologetic look and shuts the door. Alone now, though aware of their muffled voices, she looks toward the other caravans. Some are more dilapidated than others. Some are newer and quite large. She doesn't like any of them. To escape their lines of sight, she walks around Baranov's and finds herself facing the wire fence and the dead-looking buildings. She likes this no better. There is a black cable between the toes of her suede boots. She looks back and sees where it snakes from a vent in the side of Baranov's trailer. She walks forward, following it, and finds the point where it has been inserted through the fence close to the ground. It leads off through tussocks of yellow grass toward the brick compound. Electricity? From MI5 or whatever other keepers?
"Hello?"
Ngemi calls her from the side of the caravan. She walks back, pretending not to notice the cable.
"Go on," says Ngemi.
He glances at the old-fashioned calculator watch on his wrist. In his other hand, the carpet bag, looking heavier.
"I don't know how long he might give you. I'd like to catch the next train if we can."
The caravan sways as she climbs in, blinking in the dark, a gloom that reeks of stale cigarette ash and unwashed clothing horribly close. Baranov orders her to sit down and close the door. She does, discovering that what she sits on consists of books, very old ones, large, jacketless volumes with dull cloth covers. He leans forward.
"Journalist?"
"No."
"Name?"
"Case Pollard."
"American?"
"Yes." As her eyes adjust to the gloom, she sees he is partially reclining on a narrow berth that must be his bed, though it seems so steeply piled with what she takes to be wadded clothing that she doesn't see how he could sleep on it. A narrow folding table has been let down from the wall in front of him, one-legged. He jacks a pale cigarette into the corner of his mouth and leans forward. In the flare of his plastic lighter, she sees the gun. She has never looked down the barrel of a gun before, and this one seems to have very little left to look down, a huge old top-opening revolver, its barrel in the front of the trigger guard sawed roughly away, the rusted metal showing the tooth marks of hasty filing. Baranov's hand, slender and filthy, is too small for the massive wooden grip. A lanyard ring swings from the pistol's butt, suggesting tall white helmets and the Raj. She lifts her hands, a gesture familiar long ago from a children's game.
Who sent you?
I sent myself, she says, feeling faintly stupid. Ngemi says you can get information.
Does he now?
I want to trade something for one particular piece of information.
You're lying.
And then the rough metal of the muzzle, impossibly cold and distinct, is pressed against the center of her forehead. The dealer, Bond Street, the calculator from the auction, I can buy it for you. The cold ring pressing. In return, I want an encrypted email address backtraced from a digital watermark. She hears him suck his teeth, thoughtfully. I can't give you money, she says then, knowing that this is the one lie she needs to tell now, and tell well. But I can use someone else's credit card to buy the calculator for you.
Ngemi's gob needs stopping.
And then it comes to her why she mustn't offer money, though surely Big End would provide. Once paid, Baranov would then feel that he was giving his own money to a hated dealer. If I could offer you money, I would, but all I can offer is to buy the calculator, to give it to you, in exchange for what I need. Done, she closes her eyes. The circle of cold steel becomes the very horizon.
Greenaway.
Horizon withdrawn.
Do you know what he's asking?
No. Eyes tight shut.
4,005 pounds.
She opens her eyes, sees the pistol pointed not so directly at her. If we're going to talk, would you mind not pointing that at me?
Baranov seems to remember the gun in his hand.
Here, he says, tossing it onto the formica table beside her. You point it at me.
She looks from it to him.
Bought it at a boot sale. Boy dug it up in the woods here. £2. The inside's rust and earth. Cylinder won't turn.
He smiles at her. She looks back down at the gun on the table, imagining picking it up, smiling back at him, raising it, and bringing it down as hard as she can on his head. Then she looks up at him again. My offer? He pushes the revolver aside.
Tell me the details, he says.
Outside, Ngemi creaks beside her as they walk back to the car.
Was he in a better mood?
He asks. He showed me his gun.
This is England, girl,
Ngemi says.
People don't have guns.
Under Ngemi's tutelage, she emails the dealer, asking for the calculator to be placed on hold with a strong intent to buy. He had insisted she mention that she was from New York and only in London briefly. She asks Ngemi if he knows how Baranov gets his information.
Have you heard of Echelon?
No, she lies. She has. Her father had mentioned it, perhaps. Ngemi continues in the style of a lecture.
American intelligence have, perhaps, a system that allows for the scanning of all net traffic. If such a thing does indeed exist, then Baranov might be its grandfather. He may well have been instrumental in its creation. Indeed, in the creation of the net itself.
He raises an eyebrow, as if to signal that this is all he knows or is willing to say about so outré a subject. I see, she says, wondering if she does.
Well, good evening then, Case. I will phone you in the morning.
She watches the shaven dome of his large dark head descend into the London underground. Back in the flat, she checks her email, a breathless one from Parker Boy complaining of Judy and Taki's nascent love connection, one from Boone, bland and toneless as ever, and one which looks like spam, some all-numerical Hotmail address. No, not spam. Baranov, emailing from God knows where. The address she wants ends in .ru. If there's any one thing about England that Case finds fundamentally disturbing, it is how class works. A word with a very different mirror world meaning. She's long since given up trying to explain this to English friends. The closest she can come is that it's somewhat akin, if only in its enormity, to how the British seem to feel about certain American attitudes to firearms ownership, which they generally find unthinkable and bafflingly self-evidently wrong, so often leading to a terrible waste of human life. And she knows what they mean, but also knows how deeply it runs and how unlikely it is to change, except perhaps gradually and over a very long time. Class in England is like that for her. Mostly she manages to ignore it, though there's a certain way they have on first meeting of sniffing out one another's caste that gives her the willies. They look at one another's shoes first, she's convinced, and the dealer has just done that to Ngemi's Doc Martens, and he doesn't like them. Then he looks at Case's black nylon flight jacket.
You are a collector?
My father, she replies, just as Ngemi said she should.
Mr. Pollard, interrupts Ngemi, a retired American government official with a background in the sciences, has a number of Type 1 calculators, all dating from 1949, and several Type 2s as well, chosen primarily for condition and case variety.
The thumbnail of her father, not inaccurate, is the result of his gentle questioning on the pavement outside. The dealer glares at them. The blue Aunt Visa, ready in her hand, is withdrawn from her pocket and placed on the rectangular blotter-like suede pad atop the dealer's counter. He peers at it, puzzled by the Egyptianate ant, but then, she guesses, makes out the name of the issuing bank. She vaguely remembers Big N mentioning that she is authorized to buy automobiles, but not aircraft. Whatever other faults Hubertus has, she doubts he's prone to exaggeration. A block away, Ngemi carrying the boxed calculator against his stomach as though it contained the ashes of a relative, Baranov, is waiting, a half-inhaled cigarette screwed into the corner of his mouth.
That's it? Yes, says Ngemi. Authentic? Of course.
Baranov tucks the box beneath his arm and hands Case a business card. The Light of India Curry House, Pool. She turns it over. Rust-colored fountain pen, neat italics. Stellanor@armaz.ru. The eyes behind the round lenses fix Case with contempt, dismissal.
Baltic oil, is it? He snorts. Thought you might be a bit more interesting than that.
He flicks his cigarette down and walks away, the quarter prototype beneath his arm.
This is what you wanted?
Asks Ngemi as she stares down at the card at the rust-colored email address. It must be, she says. I suppose it must be.
Pattern Recognition was written by William Gibson, abridged by Ron Roberts, produced by David Jackson Young, and read for BBC Radio 7 by Lorelei King.